Right, on to our second speaker, and this time for a longer presentation. I'm very pleased to welcome Bond West from Regent's Park College here at Oxford, where Bond teaches Old and Middle English literature. He's a researcher in Old Norse as well, and he's going to be taking up the wider subject of the importance of medieval literature to the fantastic. Thank you, Bond.
Well, thank you for having me here. I wanted to start the discussion by mentioning a letter of J.R.R. Tolkien's in which he advises that if one of your children is to ask you whether dragons are still real, you don't answer no. You answer instead, oh, I don't think there are dragons in England anymore. And I wanted to start with this because I like the sensitivity to hoping that you don't ruin the possibility of the fantastic for your children, but also specifically with the fact that it locates the fantastic in one of two places, either a long time ago, there are not dragons in England anymore, or somewhere else altogether geographically, they aren't in England. I'm going to start with the point about them being elsewhere geographic because I'm not going to spend very long on it, and that's that there's a long history of locating the fantastic in places other than here. In the medieval period, writings of John Mandeville and Marco Polo, though he really did visit the East, he added many fantastical elements to his stories, or the stories of Prester John, or John, who was thought to have existed variously in India or somewhere in the Orient, or perhaps out in Mongolia, or down even in Ethiopia, all attest to ideas of there being fantastical places somewhere away from us that are vastly more interesting and perhaps magical than what we encounter every day. I want to touch on those to mention that medieval people did have some idea of locating the fantastic someplace other than where they were before kind of moving on mostly to the chronological distance between us and the fantastic. I like Tolkien's quote both as a jumping off point to mentioning this as a theme in medieval literature, but also as a theme in modern writing because of the way it impacts the way we look at the fantastic now. Gabriel mentioned that one of the most popular traits in modern fantasy is to locate it in a kind of medieval past or a fantastical other world with a highly medieval aesthetic. And I wanted to start with these three thinkers, none of whom I'm going to dwell on very long either. Over on the left, you have Max Weber, who popularized ideas about the disenchantment of the modern world. In the middle, you have Carl Jung, who really also popularized disenchantment in slightly different ways. And over there is the Canadian Roman Catholic philosopher Charles Taylor, who I've been getting lots of questions about in my time at Oxford and who previously I'd never heard of, but apparently he's really popularized the idea of disenchantment. All of them sort of pin the loss of enchantment in the world on, well, certainly Weber and Taylor pin it on the Protestant Reformation, the idea that suddenly you have a choice of deciding what is true and no, things are no longer accepted, simply metaphysical properties of things are no longer given, they're no longer accepted without question. And this is thought to have begun the process that led to things like Enlightenment thought and modern science and other aspects of modern thought that separate us from the medieval. And since standard historical periodization ends the medieval period broadly around the time of the Reformation, this rings true with the way that we characterize the fantastic by medieval a little bit, so I thought they're a nice place to start. Jung in the middle talks really more on how disenchantment applies to us, not seeing the significance in the sort of the metaphysical significance behind things. And because all of them popularize the talk of disenchantment, and because it all seems to send us back to the Middle Ages for what we look for and what makes good fantasy, I thought they'd also be good thinkers to bring into this discussion, particularly in how they impact our looking at the medieval aesthetic and medieval talk. And further thinkers have followed in their thoughts. Several more I hear about frequently at Oxford, men like Eamon Duffy and Brad Gregory, who also talk of disenchantment beginning with the Reformation, an idea that I'm sure Tolkien had some sympathy for as a Roman Catholic himself. But I also wanted to move from them to the medieval period with this quote from Chaucer, and I think this ties in nicely with Gabriel's presentation. In the old days of King Arthur, of which the Britons speak in with great honor, all was this land fulfilled of faery, the elf queen with her jolly company. I was trying to do the modern English pronunciation, and because I'm nervous, I bungled all of them. This was danced full oft in many a green mead, This was the old opinion as I read, I speak of many hundred years ago, but now can no man see none elves no more, for now the great charity and prayers of limtours and other holy friars. So medieval folk, to some extent, associated disenchantment with the coming of Christianity. So some common themes that tie their view of an enchanted past together with ours, even as we look to their present as our past. Other separations from the enchanted past have occurred throughout history. Herodotus looks back at the building of the pyramids in Egypt as something that must have been absolutely fantastical. He's writing in the 5th century BC. Homer looks back at a time when gods and men took part in the same socio-political conflicts, and he's writing probably, if there is a Homer at all, in the 8th century BC. The book of Genesis in the Bible looks back at a time before Noah's flood, when there were Nephilim, whatever that means, possibly giants walking the earth. So it's not exactly new to the modern period. There might be something very distinct about the enchantment we think we've lost that does throw us back to the Middle Ages, but you can look at fantastic literature from really throughout the sweep of history to look at people thinking that something's been lost from a previous time period. Sometimes that which has been lost is something that is worth mourning, and sometimes it's something that we're very grateful to have gotten rid of. Medieval literature will feature a little bit of both. So I want to start with one that's not clearly good or bad, at least at first glance, and that's an Anglo-Saxon poem called The Ruin. You'd probably be familiar with the arrival of the English into these islands right around the time that the Roman legions were withdrawing, sometime after 412. The exact details are not entirely known to us, but the English did encounter the ruins of Roman buildings. And this one seems to provoke an especial degree of existential dread in the poet, who looks upon the ruins and says, Ratlich is this Wailston, Wirda ye Brackon, Burgstead of Burston, Brosnath ente ye werk. Looking back at what he believes to be the ancient work of giants, because who else could have constructed something so extraordinary as the Roman ruins? It's some kind of art form that's been lost to the Anglo-Saxons, so we think probably mostly built in wood. The giants as a theme may very likely connect back to that same mention of the Nephilim in the book of Genesis. It's not 100% clear from this poem, but another bit of Old English writing you'll be more familiar with, where it is much clearer, is Beowulf, where Grendel is descended from Cain, and Cain and his progeny are thought to have been wiped off of the face of the world in the same flood that destroyed the Nephilim. And so there's sort of an implication when giants are mentioned as among the offspring of Cain, that fleeting reference to the sons of God marrying the daughters of men, and there were giants on the world in the time in Genesis, could be a reference to all the descendants of Cain, among whom are also mentioned Orkneas and Elfas. So other fantastical creatures. And of course, Grendel is a shock to the community in Heorot. He is emphatically not supposed to exist anymore. So there are elements of the fantastic coming back into the medieval imagination as an element of the past that's not supposed to exist, not as a piece of the past that they're longing for and wishing they still had. Which I think is an interesting counterpoint to some of our talk of fantasy, where it provokes a longing for some kind of a lost past in us. Both approaches to the past are evident in Beowulf, though. We might talk, I think, at great length about the role of a lost past talked about throughout the poem, certainly its relationship to the theme of death. The poem begins with Shield Shaving's funeral, which is a spectacle. And throughout the poem, we encounter great descriptions of extraordinary wealth, lots of gold, which seems to have characterized the medieval English understanding of their pre-Christian past. Gold and rings and lords giving rings. Heorot is a spectacular hall, also covered in gold and covered in and with an extraordinary tile floor, evocative more of the Roman ruins than of what we think Anglo-Saxon wood buildings looked like. But we also know from the narrator that Heorot is doomed to be destroyed by fire. So there's a lingering notion that much of the wealth and much of the extravagance of this lost world will all be lost, and that's going to happen sometime between the poem and the time that the reader is listening to it. And nowhere is this more evident than in the quote that I've put here, which is toward the end of the poem, which describes Beowulf's death and the fear that the Geats have, knowing that their lord is gone, that they might soon be gone too. the idea that the extraordinary strength and in battle, physical battle, that's being lost with people like Beowulf from the past is something that does leave their people open to utter destruction. So there is something to be longed for and mourned in some aspects of the past and some other aspects of the fantastical past that are entirely terrifying. And I like the fact that we get both themes, and we certainly do in modern fantasy too. I wanted to continue on by talking of the theme of where, I'll go next, where exactly the fantastic is hiding if it has gone, at least from England now, or in this case, Ireland. I'll make a reference to two medieval Irish texts here. I want to issue a quick apology first. I'm aware, after the time that I've lived in England, that there is either a sizable or otherwise very passionate demographic of English people who either have Irish ancestry or are otherwise really passionate about Ireland. And I'm aware that nothing infuriates you more than an American saying anything about Ireland. And I would like to, if you're sharpening your pitchforks, if I could just ask for your grace going forward. I also, I'm going to be trying to pronounce the names in these texts according to the reconstructed pronunciations from Middle Irish and not according to Modern Irish. So if they sound bad, it is partly because I'm not doing a very good job, but also because I'm not following Modern Irish pronunciation systems. So another reason to maybe ask for your grace. Well, actually, first, yes, this one in Modern Irish would be called the Leor Gabala, but in Middle Irish, it's called the Lievor Gavala, with the emphases on the first syllables. I want to start with this one. It translates roughly to the Book of the Seizings of Ireland, or the Takings, Invasions, and it's a pseudo-history, and we'll talk more about pseudo-histories in a moment. It's a pseudo-history of Ireland written, it's heavily influenced by learned and Christian Latin writings of the medieval period, and it posits a history of Ireland that sort of weaves what remains of their folklore, pre-Christian and otherwise, into a long history of Ireland that grafts into the learned Christian histories of the world, roughly aligning with the six ages of the world and positing different phases of an invasion in Ireland's history, first with the descendants of a man named Cheshire, and then a man named Portlón, and then a man named Nievith, before the arrival of a people called the Fíorbólog, and then finally the Tuatha in Modern Irish, or Tuatha in Middle Irish, the Tuatha Dé, which means the god peoples, later revised into the Tuatha Dé Danann, the children of the goddess Danu. These are the people who are thought to represent the pre-Christian deities of Ireland, and they're the ones driven into a sort of underground otherworld by the arrival of the descendants of a man named Mil España, which just translates to the Spanish soldier, the mythical founder of the Gaedelic or Gaelic peoples, a word we'll have to come back to in a minute. And I mentioned this book because that basic theme of the Tuatha Dé Danann being driven underground into a kind of other world that exists alongside our own, or alongside that of Irish Gaeldom, as being a place of locating the fantastic from the past, yes, but in a currently kind of a new holding pin, an other world that is kind of neither here nor there, but kind of there and kind of locatable in different features of the landscape, especially Neolithic tumuli, like the heavily revised New Grange picture there on the lower left, one of many sites where mortals from our world are thought to be able to contact the Tuatha, also called the sheath mounds, or the hidden people. This is a word often translated as fairies. And I bring this up because it's another element of the fantastic past, but because it exists now alongside our own, it gives us another access to the fantastical that's not simply far away in a geographic sense, but it's far away in a surprisingly near sense. And that's about all I'm going to say about this text for now. But moving forward from that, we will return to that theme shortly. I also want to talk of past efforts to reclaim elements of an enchanted past. The idea that something from that past is worth reclaiming and worth making part of our culture again for the sake of re-enchantment. So I arrive at another Middle Irish text. This is from the 12th century, called the Agla na Seanórach. And this text is, I'm really only going to talk about its frame story. The frame story is a story of Colcha mac Cronan and Oisín mac Finn, who are the last surviving members of Finn MacCoubbell's war band called the Fian. The story begins with them going about Ireland and visiting all the other last survivors of the Fian, all mourning the end of the age in which Finn MacCoubbell and his band wandered about having great adventures. And now that age is coming to a close and everything is growing dimmer and darker, the world is less fantastic, and everybody is finally dying off, Finn and Oisin have been kept alive sort of miraculously for far more centuries than what's normally natural. But then the sun rises and everything becomes bright again, because over the hill comes St. Patrick, pictured lower left. St. Patrick meets Finn McCouple and Oisin MacFinn. It turns out the reason they've been kept alive all these centuries is so they can tell him all the stories of the fantastic past and of Finn and his warband. And they can give him to St. Patrick and guide him about Ireland as they teach him about the landscape and how the lore ties in with the landscape, so that he can then carry that lore forward. He is now representative of the new Christian era in Ireland. And now Irish Christians can repurpose that lore and keep telling the stories, and the fantastic can stay with us through the storytelling. Over there on the right is a picture of Oisin, or Oisin in modern Irish, and Oisin in Scots Gaelic. And that illustration is actually from James McPherson's reimagining of the Oisin stories in the 19th century. So we can't get away from different later revisions of the story just yet. But a reminder that just as there are no two texts that are quite alike in the transmission history of the Agalov, so too the stories get reinvented time and time again, as Gabriel was telling us earlier. So that moves us into things that I hope will tie a little bit more to Oxford, since I don't know how many of you are from here, and tying to the landscape here seems like an important theme to take from the Agalov and apply to our lecture here. I mentioned pseudo-histories a moment ago, and really the paragon of all pseudo-histories in the medieval period would be Geoffrey of Monmouth, who may or may not have been Welsh, he may or may not have known Welsh, but he certainly claims to have been reviving a bit of Welsh history by putting it down into his own pseudo-history, which he claims to have derived from a book, an ancient book of the Britons in the British tongue, given to him by Walter of Oxford, the archdeacon here. Geoffrey may have even written this, and in what's in the now defunct St. George's College, which was probably somewhere around Oxford's castle, somewhere around the old tower there. This is not certain, but it is at least popularly believed here. And Geoffrey takes a wide range of folklore sources and classical sources and possibly some things just of his own invention, and weaves a fantastical history for Britain from the arrival of a mythical founder figure named Brutus, who I'll come back to in just a moment, to the final demise of the Brittonic-speaking people's hegemony over the island under Arthur at the arrival of the Anglo-Saxons. What's really interesting about this to me is that in the talk of re-enchantment and finding something from the past that gives us access to sort of enchanting the present, I'm intrigued by one of Geoffrey's main inspirations, which is Virgil's Aeneid, pictured there in the lower left. Virgil takes all of Homer's work and decides to situate Rome's enchanted past in the same mythical world as the Iliad and the Odyssey. But in doing that, he tries to sort of repurpose it going forward into something that promises that Rome is going to rise to the same heights that Troy once held. So there is a sense in which he's looking back at the fantastic of the past and looking forward at the promised fantastic of the future, which I think is an intriguing way to try to go about the project of using the past as re-enchantment. And the fact that Geoffrey draws from this, I think, is also very interesting, because whether or not he was Welsh, certainly promising a return to some kind of lost Brittonic past seems to be part of the hope expressed in his work. And two things to say about that. The first is that Brutus, the mythical founding figure of Britain, is much like Aeneas, the protagonist of the Aeneid, a refugee descended from the Trojans, who's escaped and is bringing civilization to a new place. And also, much talked about in scholarship, is what is the probability that Geoffrey wrote this in a way to legitimize the Norman aristocracy in Britain, who had sort of vague connections to the Britons through their close proximity to Brittany. They brought over a lot of Breton knights with them too, and the Bretons spoke a Brittonic language not entirely unlike Welsh, but not entirely like Welsh either. And so this ties them into the same sort of lost Trojan and ostensibly Christian past that would give them a legitimacy possibly over the Anglo-Saxons they conquered. So you can tie re-enchantment now to some extent to political ventures. I'm not entirely clear how much this should be attributed to Geoffrey and his own intentions, but a fair bit of ink's been spilt over the way it's been used since Geoffrey, in the early centuries especially. Sorry. It's often been treated as real history. That said, there's also been a very real degree to which it's been also sort of treated as pseudo-history from a very early period. It certainly popularized, though it did not originate, the practice of claiming Trojan ancestry for your country. And as other groups would go on to do, it inspired a number of other pseudo-histories. And what's interesting to me about the pseudo-history it created, especially for this, is that it posits a kind of ancient Britonic past that's either Christian or looks forward to Christianity in some kind of odd mystical way. And into that past, you can kind of throw a variety of stories that just needed to be deposited somewhere and that have allegorical resonances with Christianity in a way that evokes the fantastic to the medieval mind. And so I use it to introduce the next. I particularly enjoyed this one, but I'm going to switch the two slides around, sorry. So Sir Orfeo is a fun one. This is a medieval romance, and it's in Middle English, but it advertises itself as a Breton lay. So let's return to Geoffrey right quick. Because Geoffrey did, in fact, popularize this sort of lost Bretonic history, this helped trigger an interest in the Arthurian legend that existed before, but really, really got going, especially after him. It was especially popular in the court of Henry II for reasons I will come back to. Henry II's wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, also found it very popular in her court in France and looked for Breton storytellers to come to tell her stories about this sort of lost Bretonic past. Breton lays became very popular in French, especially the influence of Marie de France. And then lots of English writers started calling all sorts of things Breton lays. So Sir Orfeo, you will probably have already guessed, but you'll guess even more now, is a story of a king somewhere in the fantastic Bretonic past whose wife is stolen away by the king of Fairyland, and he has to go and get her back. And if that's not ringing a bell, that's the story of Orpheus and Eurydice from classical mythology, which has undergone a process of being reimagined as an actual king rather than a god. And that way you can sanitize it for Christian tastes. It's not deities we're dealing with. It's some kind of real-life hero who had some kind of interaction with the fairy otherworld. So once again, we're locating a sort of fairy otherworld in a place that is both near and far away, but also we're putting this in the ancient past where things were already more mystical. So you have different layers of how the fantastic is being built up. I wanted to start with this because since we have changed Hades into the fairy otherworld, this description of all the near-dead people in the fairy otherworld when Orpheus goes down to find his wife, whether they have They're without heads, or the Dalkinluck manuscript mentions women who died in childbirth too, which I should have picked from that manuscript so you could see more, because that's another fascinating dimension. But all people who have been killed but aren't quite dead yet. So the fairy world can exist in some sort of halfway place between the living and the dead, which I find very interesting for the sake of reimagining death for these purposes. And it allows us to play with the allegorical dimensions of life and death in a way that that evokes the fantastic, but that doesn't necessarily demand any finality. And sure enough, whereas in the classical myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, Orpheus looks back and can't get his wife out of the dead. In Sir Orfeo, he succeeds, and everybody lives happily ever after. So it is an entirely different world, a different story, but set in this world of sort of hypothetical pre-Anglo-Saxon Britain, where everything was still more mystical. As a much less heavy theme from the text, I wanted to bring up this one too. And this is a popular component of fantasy even now, I think. This describes just how lavish the fairy otherworld is. There are columns of burnished gold, and everything is made of precious stones, and there's light everywhere, whether it's day or night. The idea that the fairy otherworld is filled with finery is one that'll appear time and again in fantasy. I think one of the more interesting modern places it appears is that J.R.R. Tolkien in Lord of the Rings and C.S. Lewis in the Narnia books seem to really love descriptions of food. And I think this is maybe a survival of this same kind of theme. It's finery in a different sense, but a really enjoyable one. And this harkens back to, I think, to the descriptions of finery and the imagined pre-Christian past of the Anglo-Saxons in Beowulf. So I wanted to be sure to leave that there. We can come back to that in a moment. How am I for time? Okay. So, I'll do this one quickly just to be sure. Sir Gawain the Green Knight is another fun one, and it is also set in much more obviously Arthurian, part of the Arthurian past, in which it really is Arthur's court, and it's Arthur's nephew who goes out on an adventure. Importantly, I do like the way that it starts. Arthur won't eat until he's heard stories of adventure from his courtiers, which I've read articles and I've met scholars here who insist that that means that Arthur's kingdom is already fading away and he's looking back to his younger glory days at the beginning of the story and he's longing for them. The fact that his nephew Gawain is able to sort of bring him a story is, of course, the conceit of the whole romance, but the fact that it does start that way seems interesting too, if subtler than anything else I've mentioned before. But I also like the fact that the other world, the fantastic, bursts in to his hall, sort of unexpected, and in a way that trips everybody up a little bit, asking for somebody to cut off his head. And there is an element of the strange emerging into what's otherwise the everyday setting of the court, which is also described lavishly, so I guess we do still have the fantastic past as the setting. That notion, again, that the fantastic had sort of come into your everyday space, in this case, is not necessarily a bad thing. It is to test Gawain and to sort of call him to a higher sense of chivalry and knighthood, and it does wind up testing him, it does find him wanting, but I liked the fact that we now have the fantastic intruding on the everyday, or at least a highly fantastic reimagining of the everyday, just to play with the continued themes of which way back and forth we have the fantastic intruding for other places or ordinary people having to go to it. So I'll scoot past that really quickly and return, I think, to something else potentially Oxford-related, if only somewhat. The use of the fantastic past for socio-political aims, something I know would be of concern now or in any time period, but I wanted to talk about some of the ways that it can happen in the medieval period too. I mentioned the Oxford connection first and foremost because one of the key ways the Arthurian legend becomes popular is because of the tendency of English kings, especially Norman kings, to get crosswise with the papacy in the medieval period. Over there on the right, that's a picture of the murder of St. Thomas Becket. He seems like a good place to start because his death was ordered by King Henry II, who ruled from here in Oxford. And if you want to go see a historical marker, the marks where his palace used to be, it's over there by the Ashmolean. And he probably kept his mistress, Rosamond, in Godstow Abbey, just up the river from here. So many connections to Oxford. But one of the uses of the Arthurian legend, or one of the things that makes it so handy to have this sort of fantastical past, is the way in which it can be sort of leveraged to give the English kings a bit of legitimacy in their strife against the papacy. Worth noting that Henry's son John also had some issues with the papacy in his dispute over the ordination of Archbishop Stephen Langton and his following excommunication. But one of in the broader nexus of stories that all get funneled into Arthuriana and into this sort of mythical past of a pre-Anglo-Saxon England, one of the key stories is the arrival of Joseph of Arimathea, the man who lent Jesus his tomb, on this island, ostensibly either bringing Jesus as a child or later bringing Jesus' blood in the form of the Holy Grail. And this is integral to many different versions of the Arthurian legend. But the idea that there is some ancient semblance of the Christian church here that predates the arrival of Rome's influence through the Augustinian mission at Canterbury, and especially tied to Glastonbury, pictured there on the left, gives at least the literary imagination of the time a way of framing England's past as something that shares in the same deep connections to Christian history that Rome can claim for its own legitimacy. And the fact that this ancient British past also claims Rome's secular legitimacy from Troy is just a great double whammy. This happens in the midst of controversies surrounding investiture, which again gets back to Archbishop Stephen Langton, but also conciliarism with the question of how much role does Rome have in determining the course of the Church of England. What is so important about this to the reception of the wider Arthurian legend in the medieval period is that because Arthur gains some legitimacy both through his kingship and his descent from Troy and also from some kind of connection to Joseph of Arimathea, he can become sort of a figure who represents both divine and political justice all at the same time. It's important to note, too, that many of his meeker and milder attributes in some versions of the legend always sort of characterized by the fact that the Virgin Mary is painted on his shield, seem to contribute to this overall notion of him being a sort of a somewhat holy kind of king. Obviously, there are many flaws to that oversimplification we'll come back to in a minute too. But it helps to position any claims of connecting the Norman monarchy to this kind of figure, or at least pasting this kind of fantastical past onto England in a way that is especially useful for conceiving of England as a holy place that may have some kind of distinction from the church, which is sort of above or otherwise free from Norman justice. You can flee to a church and gain sanctuary if you're trying to run from Norman justice, for example. So finding a way to unite the two in your imagination is handy. We will come back to that in a minute. I won't dwell a whole lot on Thomas Malory, but particularly I'm interested now also in reclaiming this kind of mystical past of a grand and semi-holy England. I've given a quote not from Malory, but from Caxton here, because that shows you how Malory has been received by later generations, more so than simply what he wrote himself. This is a bit of hand-wringing over the fact that Caxton wants people to read the Arthurian legend so they can learn how to behave well from the good behavior in the Arthurian legend. And it's more nuanced than just that. He dismisses the bad behavior in it too. But the fact that there was a time period when chivalry was a real thing is of some importance. Legend would have that Thomas Malory wrote much or possibly all of the Morte d'Arthur from prison. Whether that's true or not, I hear is a really controversial question, because the identity of who Thomas Malory is hotly contested, or was. There are multiple Thomas Malorys from the time period, and some people believe it's a pseudonym, and some people believe that it's a misattribution. But what certainly seems to be the case is that whoever he was, he lived sometime toward the end of the Wars of the Roses, when England was at war with itself. And so it's at least very realistic to imagine that looking back at a lost time period of finery and chivalry and good behavior was something he associated with watching England rip itself apart and longing for a past that may or may not have existed, but that certainly was better than the present, which is, I think, the theme we all have when we romanticize the past. And whether or not that's really Malory's intention, it certainly seems to be Caxton's intention, and for many centuries, Caxton's edition of Malory was our primary source for the text before the rediscovery of the Winchester manuscript. That's really the main point I want to look at with Malory for now, is that longing for a past that was nobler is also seems to be closely tied with our ideas of the fantastic. Because scholars have noted that Malory, in his use of the sources for other bits of the Arthurian legend, has actually removed a lot of fantastical elements. Whether this is really to play up the fact that the morals of the past were more fantastic or not is debated, but it's at least a lingering possibility. So in talking of retrieving the past, I thought I'd mention another Oxford connection. The man on the lower left is William Morris, and Morris Automotive was based over there on, I think, Holywell Road's the name of it. And I mention this because in the 19th century, as much of European society was rapidly moving towards the cities and also rapidly industrializing, there was a widespread view that some aspect of the past was being lost all over again, a recurring theme now. And this also coincides with the hope of finding sort of a rekindled interest in the past by looking at England's shared medieval identity. So William Morris is a great example of trying to bring forward this kind of re-enchantment in his art. This looks sort of like a medieval tapestry, but it's not. It's one of Morris's design, but he also produced textiles that evoked medieval art. And is a founding member of both what we call the Pre-Raphaelite movement and also the Arts and Crafts movement with varying forms of arts and crafts movement, specifically with varying forms of textiles and of wallpapers that all have prints inspired by medieval tapestries and medieval art, trying to bring something to the industrialized world that evokes the enchantment of the past. Again, the medieval period is the one that's chosen for this, which plays really well, I think, with Gabriel's talk of the centrality of the medieval identity to our modern ideas of fantasy. I want to take a quick sidestep and talk about medieval cosmology, which I think is a bigger topic than we can say a whole lot about. But this old geocentric notion of the universe, in which all of the different layers of the universe that are marked out by the different seven heavens sort of interlock like a Russian matryoshka, one of those nesting dolls, and they all sort of spin and grind against each other in the way the moving stars or the planets rise and fall. And the heavens impacts the way different elements interact with each other and different personalities change here on Earth. The way that plays together with where medieval thinkers located angels and located different spirits and different forces and located different levels of heaven you could rise to gave the world kind of a sense of knowability. And I think a lot of times when we talk about re-enchantment, what we're longing for is a sense of mystery and the lack of knowability that we think is lost in the face of modern science thinking it can understand anything. I think the reality is you could play either one in kind of either direction. But the knowability back then seems to be more closely aligned with kind of a mystical or a metaphysical knowability. I suppose a modern scientific view would be more of a mechanistic knowability. And so I think, especially now, as you get people who are interested in fantasy, who then fall back to reading medieval literature and find it very interesting to read things like Dante, where you move through the different layers of heaven, especially in Paradiso, and learn about their significance and their relationship to life here on Earth, that does provide a kind of enchantment not unlike the other fantastical elements we've been looking at. So I wanted to make a brief aside to it. I wanted to mention this quote by C.S. Lewis, because I know we associate him with a lot of modern fantasy too. And it's that I have made no serious effort to hide the fact that the old model, his term for the way everything fits together in medieval thought, the old model delights me, as I believe it delighted our ancestors. Few constructions of the imagination seem to me to have combined splendor, sobriety, and coherence in the same degree. It's possible that some readers have long been itching to remind me that it has a serious defect. It was not true. Which I think is something worth kind of bringing to mind too, as we think of the relocation of the fantastic increasingly into other worlds, not necessarily other worlds that are accessible, like those of medieval Ireland, accessible through the Sheathed Mounds, but now entirely relocated to other books, things like Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, Lewis's Narnia, what have you. And I wanted to bring that to mind just because it seems related to our concepts of re-enchantment. And it's certainly related to the way we now look at the Middle Ages as one of enchantment, even if probably they didn't view it as quite the same thing as the fantastic. So I wanted to talk too about re-enchantment through the study of folklore. This is one that I find very interesting. I won't take too much of your time on it. But over on the right, we have Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm, who you know from compiling fairy tales. But they were compiling fairy tales again at a time when society was industrializing and everybody's moving to the cities, and folklore was something that everybody was afraid was going to be lost. This initiates sort of an interest in compiling folklore everywhere. You get people like Asbjørnsen and Moe, whose Norwegian folktales are pictured there on the left, who go about Norway gathering up folktales there. You get Croft and Croker and to some degree Yeats over in Ireland, who do the same thing with Irish mythology, going about different regions of Europe and gathering up those folk tales in the hope that you could rekindle some kind of lost identity of the past, something now mystical that's been lost with the rise of industrialization. Seems to me not unrelated to the way we receive the concepts of medieval fantastic and the way we imagine everything from those folk stories to be set in the Middle Ages. So I wanted to briefly touch on the fact that the distinct form of this in Ireland, again, my continued apologies, but there we have from the Celtic revival, depictions of the Tuatha Dé on the right and of the Druids with the mistletoe on the left. The fact that you could sort of re-enchant scholarly ideas of what the Druids might have been like and really play them up for romantic purposes. Something that has not been as well received when it was done amongst the Germanic-speaking peoples, because that led to things like Wagner's operas and far nastier things later. But the degree to which trying to sort of reincorporate some of this enchantment into daily life, it also seems noteworthy to me, and the way it plays together with trying to sort of recover lost ideas about what a nation's identity might be will come up again in just a moment, especially as we tie everything back up with the Arthurian legend in a moment. But first, I'm also interested in re-enchantment here in Oxford again in religious settings. I mentioned finery as an important facet of enchantment in medieval writing. Well, I could think of no more entertaining example, because you can go walk through it, that the Oxford movement was an effort to try to re-enchant Anglicanism by trying to add elements of medieval belief back into it, especially sometimes that were illegal. We don't have to talk too much about it because I'm not a theologian, you're not here to learn about theology, but the way it aligns with aesthetic movements that tried to bring back Gothic architecture from the medieval period and bring back, well, not bring back, but use lots of the arts and crafts movements wallpapers and curtain hangings and things like that. Keble College here was built during that. Look at all the gold everywhere. Beowulf would die. Efforts to make things in Oxford look medieval when in fact they weren't are really the main thing I wanted to look at, but also the way that does play together with trying to tie back to a medieval past in the context of religion. And I particularly am interested in the way some of these thinkers, especially Daubigny and let me make sure I have the other guy's name right here in the lower corner. Oh, I don't have it off the top of my head, but they actually sort of repurpose a lot of the old arguments about Glastonbury and Canterbury and their arguments that the Anglican Church is a special third branch of apostolic succession. And Daubigny did actually claim that the Anglican Church was founded by Joseph of Arimathea. So you do see the return of a lot of medieval ideas of enchantment in the 19th century in ways that still inform our ideas about fantasy now. And the fact that you can go see them in Oxford, there are a great many medieval-looking buildings here that are in fact Victorian, that date to that time period. So I also wanted to end, just very briefly, with T.H. White, but I won't take, we don't have very much time, so I'll just briefly run through it. I mentioned the love of finery and fantasy, and I mentioned the way that with Tolkien and Lewis it seems to appear in the love of food, and one of my favorite things about T.H. White is his love of describing clutter and the way you find fantasy there. And since it does bring us back to the Arthurian legend, I thought it would be a fun place to end. And this is I'm not going to read the whole thing because it was many pages long, but when Arthur first meets Merlin and goes into his house, there's a fantastic, and I mean that in both senses of the word, description of all the clutter in there. And so among the things in the list of Merlin's clutter is extensive numbers of taxidermed animals, including a corkandrill, which is an old word for a crocodile, and then a long list of birds, and my favorite little mention is a reputed phoenix, but then the narrator says, of course, it couldn't have been a phoenix because everybody knows there can only be one at a time. And then long descriptions of leather-bound books, some of them chained, and also the smell of must and solid brownness, which was most secure, which I thought was a nice description of the feeling of going into an old library. And then things like live animals crawling around, fly fishing lures, an astrolabe to make reference back to the medieval model of the heavens, but also a Bunsen burner to make reference forward to the modern concept of science. An Encyclopedia Britannica, just to round out our anachronisms, paint boxes, and finally a talking owl. But what I like about this is the way you can sort of access the feeling of the fantastic by exploring all these basically educational but still mundane items, always with a little hint there's something fantastic hiding around the corner. A reputed phoenix, oh, but it's not real. Oh, an owl, oh, it is real, it does talk, you know. And I like that way of accessing the fantastic through fantasy. How are we for time? Should I just end it? 2 minutes? Yeah, I think I'll cut it there because I think the last few things were already better said by Gabriel. So I think that's a better note to end on anyway. So thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Bond, and Gabriel as well. That's exactly what we were looking for in terms of setting the scene, the importance of medieval literature to fantasy and the appropriations. So I think we've got time for questions. First of all, shall we look to the room? Does anyone have a question or a comment?
I wondered if I could ask, you talked a lot about and I think you touched on kind of the medieval ideas of looking back to the past as being quite linked to nationalism and that idea of national identity. Do you think that can sometimes be quite harmful, especially in a modern culture where we're kind of thinking about Britain's impact on the rest of the world and how that was sometimes justified through medievalism?
Yeah, I deliberately skirted around some of that for fear that it would be insensitive to say some of it directly, but is it... which actually might have the opposite effect, so I probably should have thought about the importance of saying some of it. So I guess I'm glad you asked, because I mentioned with the collection of folklore and the way in Germany that led to things like the rise of Wagner's operas, and Wagner had some fairly nasty opinions, but I guess to be more blunt, Wagner's operas became a real core piece of Nazi iconography. Is that a bad word? There's been a real pushback against that kind of study of the Germanic languages and the Germanic past that has been I think, much more thorough. There's not been quite the same political need for one with the medieval Irish stuff, because Ireland hasn't been out conquering anybody. And, but yeah, so the short answer is that, yeah, it can be. And, I mean, you could argue, I mean, the ins and outs of the political scene between Henry II and the Pope are all distant from us now, but, I mean, it was being used for things that I'm sure some found harmful at the time, too, perhaps for very different reasons, but, yeah, it could all be weaponized if used incautiously, but I would hope everybody here plans to use it cautiously, so.
We have one question. You connected the story of Sir Thomas Becket to the use of a fantastical past to achieve political aims. Could you talk a little more about how saints and pilgrim stories connect to the medieval base for contemporary fantasy?
Yeah, I wrote a thesis on it, so I should have a better answer, but I was just stumped by the number of things that came to my head. Because you have sort of a competition between them, don't you? And that Rome really sort of, at this time period, around the time of Henry II and John, Rome would have more of an influence on the fantastical component of the saints. And then I don't want to posit a clear and like sharp distinction against the Arthurian stuff, because that's not exactly true. The Cistercians play a really big hand in popularizing the Arthurian legend. And it's, especially in its spread up to Scandinavia. Around Bergen. So there's a lot of cross-pollination between the two. Should I start with Becket? Is that the right thing to do? Because with Becket, it becomes a really popular saint's life. But positing an entire separate history in which there is sort of a fantastic and highly Christianized or Christianizable history that looks sort of like saints' lives does create a bit of extra tension, just in legitimizing or sort of magically legitimizing. I don't know that anybody really believed it so much as it was just a popular theme in the literature. The British crown, that was the main point I was trying to get at. But the fact that you do have a lot of really virginal type characters in the Arthurian legend seems to be an influence from, if not specifically the Cistercians, certainly the role of saints' lives. Galahad, Percival, and even though Arthur has an affair with a sister and is married and such, his depictions, especially in Malory, can be often very meek and mild. To get back to the fact that Geoffrey always has him with Mary painted on his shield, trying to capture something saintly about him does seem to be one of the aims of the story, in that you could find a lot of room for just finding character complexity and complexity for talking about sin. And the way that does play off hagiographic themes is important, because he's, of course, not really fulfilling any of them. But in a sense, he's kind of broadcasting them all the same, if in broken forms. So it's not a great answer to your question, but there is... Yeah, the hagiographic component is, I think, very real, probably one that isn't very much talked about anymore. So now I'm wondering if that's what the lecture should have been about after all. But I just hope that was helpful.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking of pre-conquest lives of the saints. So right. Alfred of Aynsham. And if you, his one of the common plot structures in that, which he's drawing from other sources, is once the saint is martyred, usually for a martyr, then it's the miracles afterwards, because that's what earns you money. If you've got a saint that's going to sort of blind or sort of somehow disable the thieves trying to get into their tomb or something and perform posthumous miracles, that's the people that the ones that people want to come and see on pilgrimage, and they'll come on pilgrimage and they'll give you money, etc. So it's a common plot structure post death that's where the fantasy comes in, or fantastical elements. There we are.
Thank you.
Sorry, can I just follow up on that? And also, you've got a whole bunch of dragon-bashing saints. Like, I did a book on Margaret of Antioch, and of course, when Jacopo says, like, oh, you know, that episode is really apocryphal, everyone else is like, let's ignore him. Let's just keep the dragon episode, all right? And then you've got St. Michael and St. George and all that. But I was listening to you, and it occurred to me something I never thought before. You know, when you have an experience of the fairy, the other world, it's supposed to be dangerous, right? And we see that in Sir Orfeo. You kind of said, yeah, they all lived happily ever after. But Lady Eurydice never speaks again. She's a zombie. Like, it's a terrifying end. And then, of course, with Sir Gawain Greenknight, you know, once he's got the experience, he's kind of permanently marked with that experience. And then I kind of don't really see that until Tolkien talks about fairy as, you know, something quite dangerous and something which kind of affects you. And I'm wondering, maybe from your experience and maybe Stuart and Caroline and others, do we have this in more recent fantasy? Because certainly we've got the idea that magic or fairy, whatever, can be both good and bad. But do we have this, like, you know, if, don't go there, it's dangerous.
Well, the example that immediately springs to mind is one I mentioned about Narelle and Morris with the, because they get sucked into the elven world, don't they? And that is a place of danger in that strange case. So that would be the one I'd immediately think. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I would say that it obviously does go through 19th century as well. Perilous place. We've mentioned that already, and it may come up in a bit about, you know, the perilous realm, as Tolkien called it, the fact that you could get dragged off into an underground cavern of fairyland or the woods or whatever, and as Caroline mentioned, time completely changes there, but you may never get away from the enchantment. So it does run through particularly folklore and fairy tale, but it has been picked up in modern tales. Yeah. And so the elves in The Hobbit are not particularly nice either. Mm. They're probably based on Sir Orfeo as well, because, you know, they capture the dwarves. They won't let them out. They're all, yeah.
The keys to Middle-earth.
Yeah. Yep.
How modern is modern for your question's purpose?
I'm thinking maybe 21st century, because, okay, like, you know, our view of these things changed as, like, our view of religion changed, our view of society changed. And, like, I'm struggling to think of a more recent example, probably, except for Emily White's Encyclopedia of Fairies, where there's, like, a scholar who goes to whatever Norse country, and, you know, these guys are dangerous. And it's not like, you know, there are no redeeming features at all. Like, they're just plain dangerous.
But it's the premise of fairy core, isn't it? That the world of the fairies is both alluring, and it has all of the splendour of the fairy king's kingdom in Sir Orfeo. And indeed, you get it in folk tale all the time, that the place of the fairies is where you want to go, and they want to keep you there. And escaping is really, really hard. With fairy core, the return to the contemporary world, or kind of the normal world, as it were, is usually quite temporary, partly because these are series. So you've always got to go back again for your next fix of the fairy world. And I think, although Goblin Market, Christina Rossetti's poem, doesn't mention the word fairy, nevertheless, it's absolutely chock full of that kind of fairy, particularly the trope of fairy food and how dangerous it is. I'm just writing a book about fairies.
My knowledge of modern fantasy sort of, I've exhausted for this talk, so...
But I'll give a plug for tomorrow. I think Felix Taylor is talking about Arthur Machen, and he writes some weird tales about the little people, about resurfacing in the 1910s and 1920s, and they're not particularly nice. So I would just like to really thank again Gabriel and Bond for a wonderful session on medieval. Thank you very much.